your favorite source for Chicago White Sox talk, delivering news, interviews, analysis, and more. This is the Sox Machine Podcast with your hosts, Jim Margulis, James Fegan, and Josh Nelson.
Thanks, Rob, and welcome to a new episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Nelson, and it's Monday night, November 17th, 2025, as we record this new episode. This past weekend was my 41st birthday, and I hope Justin Verlander stays in the league so I'm not older than everybody in Major League Baseball, and I spent it in New Orleans. So I've been off the MLB and White Sox radar these past couple of days, but good news, we got James Fegan, who was on site for the GM meetings in Las Vegas, came back with some very useful intel that you read on SoxMachine.com and how this offseason could go for the White Sox. Who could be a left-handed corner infielder the White Sox are targeting? On that note, should the White Sox be on somebody like Brendan Donovan, as he is now available for trade, part of the St. Louis rebuild, reload, whatever they're doing down there? Plus, Grant Taylor, the catching duo sticking together for now. And we hope you like the DH role, Andrew Benintendi. In the end, we'll share our thoughts as Josh Naylor is staying in Seattle on a new five-year contract. So let's get started. In helping me catch up, joining me is Sox Machine's beat reporter James Fegan and managing editor Jim Margulis. And gentlemen, hello. There is a baseball offseason deadline for Tuesday, November 18th. There's two of them. One, players that have been offered the qualifying offer must accept or decline. And then it is the 40-man protection deadline for MLB teams to protect their prospects and other players from the Rule 5 draft during the winter meetings. Obviously, the White Sox don't have to worry about the qualifying offer, James. But for the 40-man protection for the Rule 5 draft, any guesses in who the White Sox could add as their 40-man roster currently stands at 35?
Man, I haven't thought about a White Sox qualifying offer probably since Rodon post-2021. Have there been any like really big close decisions since then? Anyway, give him a Cy Young vote this year. There's... like they're actually going to do something for 40-man edition, but it's not a crunch sort of situation or a big will they or won't they. I think Tanner McDougal, they've already pretty much said they're going to add, and I think Peyton Ballett is right on that line of, you know, kind of near ready reliever who, you know, needs protection and seems like he should be useful. You can definitely see him pitching the majors next year. Maybe he spun his wheels a little bit in terms of like establishing himself as a future leverage option this season. But with them having five open slots, you know, even expecting him to, you know, be active in Rule 5 or be opportunistic where they could wind up claiming somebody at the end of spring next year, not that they're planning that, so to speak, I think they have as much room to add as someone they want, which, if anything, there's more drama in who they kind of wind up officially, unofficially declaring, like, we're not huge believers in. Like, if they don't reward Shane Murphy, which I think there's an argument to, like, that's not even just not a statement of confidence. It's more of a statement of, like, feeling like that's not the profile that's going to get claimed in a Rule 5 situation. Someone who's, like, kind of a depth arm where might have his – probably if he's going to have a major league career – you'd see the first couple years being where he's available depth that he can go up and down. And that's not what teams use Rule 5 picks more. It's more about people, you know, hoping that the stuff allows them to pop up to a level of performance they haven't been before. It's kind of, you know, how it worked for Shane Smith, even to a degree, even if you kind of associate that reliever. So I think it's probably chalk with McDougal and Paulette. You can, if you really have a strong arm, or certainly if they have a strong arm for someone else on the fringes, they obviously have room, but I don't think there's a lot of situations where their hands are being forced. And if anything, they're probably oriented for another off season of working the waiver wire or seeing kind of interesting projects that get claimed, maybe with a little bit higher ceiling than what they have on the Rule 5 protection, you know, kind of threshold, will they, won't they line.
Got it. So, Jim, on my list, I had McDougal and Paulette, as James mentioned. I also had Mason Adams. Is he currently not on the 40-man roster, or could they add him, and then could they 60-day IL him because he's still recovering from injury?
Yeah, he's I think if he were somebody who would be projected to come back in the first half of the season, they might protect him just because Tommy John surgery is kind of a way for a team to have an easier time having somebody on the roster for 90 days because you know, he could open the season on the 60-day IL, join the team in June, you know, maybe like a strategic IL placement. Then you get to September, rosters expand, and all of a sudden the 90 days are up. But I think everybody who had Tommy John surgery, like that cluster of surgeries in February through April, that Chris Getz said the winter meetings, according to James, and he can tell me if I'm wrong, that it sounds like Prelander Barreau is the only one expected to come back or maybe have an impact or return in the first half of the season. Everybody else is more after the All-Star break, which would not leave 90 days to come back and be on the roster. And then they have to do the same thing again next year. So I think, you know, Adams, Juan Corella was another one. They might have been targets had they been projected to come back in May. But if they're looking at July, even like late June would probably leave too little time for them to come back and make it worth another team's while, especially since, you know, they're kind of in the same boat as Murphy. As depth arms, guys who are more valuable throwing five innings than throwing one or two because they're not projected to be high leverage stuff. The other one that I kind of thought based on the White Sox trading for him was Ben Peoples as a reliever who might, if he appealed to the White Sox, would he appeal to another team in a relief audition, give him back at the end of spring training if it doesn't matter? But given that he didn't really show for the White Sox, he had some good innings, but also some not good innings. And then I think he missed the last week or two of the season. I don't know if he showed enough to where the White Sox feel all that invested. They'd rather have the roster spot open for claiming somebody themselves. So yeah, I think it's a two horse race unless like Murphy was just so good, you know, with the 1.6 something ERA, I think second lowest qualifying ERA among minor leaguers to where they would just feel stupid if another team claimed him and like he was good enough and they'd just be like, well, we had roster spots. We have guys we can cut if we need to open roster spots. Why did we get too cute with it? But like James said, it's not somebody who's going to leap with stuff, like unless he makes a Shane Smith type leap where all of a sudden he's like throwing two or three ticks harder. In spring training, then all of a sudden, like he's a completely different pitcher and a different profile. But if they don't have that sort of idea for him, if they think he's maxed out and he's going to be a four-pitch guy who gets by with guile, and it seems like they were more or less delaying the inevitable by having him spend so much time in Birmingham and not promoting him to Charlotte till the last couple weeks of the season, that they're not huge believers in him, and his first couple starts in Charlotte, while effective, featured more walks and more nibbling. Like, it might be a case where they just, you know, they feel Charlotte might be ugly for him, and we're just trying to hold out until next year.
So we should be, I guess, for White Sox fans, expect to not have a full 40-man roster after the deadline on Tuesday. That it'll be around 37 to 38 players on the 40-man roster. Is that
Yeah, I
fair to
would say
say?
38 at most.
38 at most. That kind of makes it fun, though, because depending on who gets cut or who gets placed on waivers to make room for other players. Yes, it's not, I guess it's not fun for a lot of people who are in the offseason plan projects, White Sox fans that are sick and tired of the White Sox continuing to shop in the clearance aisle. I understand that. But it is an opportunity for White Sox to maybe pluck somebody from somewhere else that's essentially free and add them to the 40-man roster. Because the next topic, what did I miss from the GM meetings? And since Jim mentioned it, that is one of the concerns that I have, again, is starting pitching depth for the White Sox and what they actually are going to have on hand in the first half of the season. But James, coming back from Las Vegas, from the GM meetings, getting a chance to chat with Chris Getz and others within the White Sox organization last week, what was your biggest takeaway, in your opinion, from the GM meetings in Las Vegas?
I can assure you there are a handful of young men who watch White Sox bullpen sessions and team polos who are very excited about having open spots from the waiver wire to file reports about. I think that there, for me, there wasn't like some big bright shining takeaway from the meetings. There's a lot of like little items. I think if you're a reader, or certainly from what I got from the comments, a big takeaway was maybe reaffirmation of how little or how much there's not intent to shop for impact free agents or really spend money or add budget to the roster this year. I don't think it was surprising, but I think it could easily be your top takeaway. That's probably more of a big picture item going forward than Grant Taylor's or Walker McKibben taking over catching instruction. Those were, you know, items I had top of line that I wanted to hear more about. But I think the fact that this is another rebuilding offseason is probably the big vibe that people got from my piece.
Yeah, but I don't think that's a surprise, Jim, because, I mean, we talked about it all during the season. And this is where I'm going to keep hammering this point. White Sox, you need a president of operations. Okay? It cannot be Jerry Reinsdorf. Who within the Chicago White Sox organization is going to stand in front of the firing line of paying customers and media and be honest about the revenue situation with the ball club and how that's impacting what they can do, what kind of product they can put on the field? Brooks Boyer? Is Brooks that guy? It's not Chris Getz. Chris has words of optimism and he believes that they're on the right track and they are not going to deviate from where they are. But there's a lot of White Sox fans, Jim, that do not like this track and they are getting impatient, and I don't blame them. I really don't. It's been a lot of losing for a long time. The White Sox have been one of the worst teams in Major League Baseball in the last decade, especially when you look at wins and losses. But it's clearly not 89-year-old Jerry Reinsdorf. He's not going to pull a Tim Cook. I mean, this is what every major organization and company in the world does. The CEO goes out there and they speak to the paying customers. Tom Ricketts does this for the Chicago Cubs. They have a president of operations, but the White Sox do not. And I feel like if you have Brooks Boyer try to sell a message of, well, guys, this is why we don't spend because we don't have any money, I don't think he's the right guy either. So, again, this is where White Sox business operations-wise is still falling short.
I guess my takeaway from it is that, like, people talk a lot about the vision of Chris Getz, but a lot of that is very, very process-oriented, where, like, everything they talk about is about putting their head down and improving, like, these departments, and if they keep doing that, the organization will be in a better place and they'll look up and be happy. But, like, it's very hesitant to articulate, like, when will things be done by, like, when they expect to be contending by, or what's the vision? Will this be a team that's like the Brewers and thus is, like, in the playoffs regularly and can win their, like, division that doesn't have, like, any huge heavy hitters in it? Or is this, like, an operation they expect to, like, to win a World Series at some point? And God knows, like, the last front office talked about winning World Series seemingly before they were ready to, and this front office, like, doesn't need to get into the trap of doing the same thing. But it's almost like it's swung all the way to the other end, where it's, you know, we can never dream about, like, the steak being done. It's all about, like, burying yourself in every process of cooking it and improving, like, the surface on which it's prepared and the sourcing of the beef and the idea of eating the steak. Like, that's not, like, that's nowhere, that does not involve in the work of preparing it. And it's just not worth considering because they're not even close to eating it. So why even talk about it? Only that can only distract us from the process of making it. So I feel like that's kind of my general vibe of it.
It's low and slow, 150 degrees for 300 years.
The White Sox, this is the honest dialogue. The White Sox are $285 to $300 million revenue team. The Chicago Cubs are going to be between $450 and $500 million. The Dodgers, thanks to Ohtani, are going to generate $1 billion by themselves. And the first question White Sox fans are going to point at the White Sox and say, why is your revenue that low? And the White Sox are to point the finger back at the paying customer and say, you don't spend enough. Well, you don't give me reason to spend money. And that's where everybody is.
I think they've advanced beyond that. I think they've advanced beyond that. Now they say,
and now you don't have Project 78. So you can't even use that anymore.
Yeah. Yep. No, it's it seems like the public spokesperson is going to be Chris Getz. It is. seems like Jerry Reinsdorf likes him. He does. I think
it's just not, it's not Chris's job, Jim.
I know. I was making a Chris Getz joke. I was about his favorite verbal tick. But no, it's to me, like if I'm going into 2027 labor talks or you know, post 2026 labor talks, I'd say like the White Sox are a good example of like, must not be that bad. Like if you don't have to show any kind of like, if you don't have to excite the paying customer at all with your acquisitions or your network or your overall product, like can't be terrible. They can't be hemorrhaging cash. It can't be untenable. And they can't be, losing their shirts over there. If everybody keeps their jobs and like the headcounts seems pretty stable and they can just kind of keep their heads down, keep plugging away at, you know, all these process things and never having any kind of timeline to show for it. So, you know, as Rob Manfred says, teams are losing money. Like I would say probably not. And I think the White Sox are maybe one of the best examples in the league.
Yeah. And again, you're going to use this though, reason why the payroll is going to be $80, $90 million.
Yeah.
But for everyone in Sox Machine in the comment section, I still think that they're right. They have a right to be angry about it.
Oh yeah.
Like how did it get this bad?
No, it's terrible business. It's penny wise and dollar stupid, and even sometimes penny stupid and dollar stupid.
Yeah, this is where Jerry Reinsdorf and Brooks Boyer are failing Chris Getz. And Brooks feels like, Chris, we can't be in rebuilding mode all the time, but Chris is going to turn around and say, you're not giving me any money to spend. So how am I supposed to do this, guys? And that's to James's point. Process-oriented, make improvements internally, and hopefully those internal improvements in the department and a new Dominican Academy will turn out really good players that we have to spend very little money on. And they give us huge boosts on the field. And then maybe fans will come. Or you sell... and the new guy comes in and infuses the team with a bunch of cash, willing to go in the red to convince the other MLB owners this will pay off big time for the White Sox as we aim to make this a $350, $400 million annual revenue team instead of where it is today, which is bottom three in Major League Baseball.
Put our head down and focus on the work day to day. We'll look up at one point and the team will have been sold.
Yeah.
Lo and behold.
One day. All right.
That's the parade.
So if that's the biggest takeaway for podcast listeners and Sox Machine readers, is that the team's not going to
see you next year.
Yeah. Yeah. But for everybody else sticking around wondering how in the world are they going to build this team and trying to build off what they accomplished in the second half. One of the things that caught my attention, Jim, that James reported was the White Sox looking for a left-handed hitting corner infielder who can play a little third base. My first question...
Doesn't have to,
but could play a little third base.
Vargas guys that and Colts Montgomery can cover there. Like, they don't... They're not defensively...
Brooks Baldwin can cover there.
But left-handed hitting corner infielder. Jim, why would that be a need for the White Sox?
Well, we saw some Ryan O'Hearn murmurs. Was that Bruce Levine...
Did I miss that?
Was that a Bruce Levine source?
It was. You asking doesn't suggest that you did miss that. It kind of answers your own question.
Yeah. Just, you know, case of, you know, popular in the offseason plan project. If they were tipping their hand of like somebody they'd like, somebody they feel like there's, you know, if maybe they were describing who that might be, obvious Ryan Fuller connection in that, like, he's one of like the feathers in Fuller's Baltimore cap. And you know, and the Royals were certainly furious when they gave all that playing time to Ryan O'Hearn, who was terrible. And then like, he goes to Baltimore and turns into like the ideal affordable left-handed complimentary platoon type. Like you would be that kind of player. So I don't know if that's a case where talking about who fits it and they have like a hunch, but, can't necessarily land that yet. And it seems like O'Hearn is somebody who's accomplished enough to have better choices unless the White Sox want to pay him. So that was just like the first thing that jumped out to me.
The prevailing explanation provided, that was a too wordy play to say that. What Getz said was, if you look at first to third base, they're mixed. You got Vargas, you got Lenin Sosa, you got Chris Mead. You can throw in Brian Ramos, he didn't mention him by name. But then there, those are all your first to third baseman, you know, throw in Brooks Baldwin as well. But like those four, the main four, those are all right-handed and they want someone to balance that out. Now, how are they going to balance that out and get playing time for Meade, Sosa, Vargas? I don't know. Probably not get playing time for all of them, but they certainly aren't happy with like the lineup balance of that as it currently stands. Sosa's kind of neutral because he doesn't, you know, abide by society's rules, but he can't probably be said to be like a true like reverse split or righty masher guy at this point. They feel like they want someone they can throw in there and feel good about their having the platoon advantage against right-handers of that position group. And
to circle back, James, because of New Orleans, I recall seeing the tweet about Ryan O'Hearn and the interest of the White Sox. I have forgot that I had seen
it. It might be forgettable in like a week or so.
Maybe. I like the idea though. I don't hate bringing in Ryan O'Hearn. He could play some first. He can fake it in right field. I don't hate
it. Yeah, I think for them it'd be a good get. It's more like O'Hearn was, you know, playing on a playoff team and getting regular opportunities in the second half, and you know, theoretically we'd have them in his market again, you know, this offseason. Wouldn't necessarily be a pure case of like they would have to work hard to be like this is a level of opportunity different than what he could get a contender, because I think there'd be another contender be like, hey, come be a strong side of platoon over here.
Yeah, he would be like a good true. Will Venable pathways to victory guy.
What I do hate is going on Fangraphs and looking at the free agent tracker and see who's available for guys who are left-handed infielders. Not a great list. I mean, at the top is Jorge Polanco, but to James's point, he was just on a playoff team that almost made the World Series last year. And I still, maybe he returns to Seattle. That would be a good get for the White Sox, but I feel like Jorge Polanco can still get another contract with the contender.
They did just in signing in Naylor, because I wrote up Polanco for Fangraphs' top 50 free agents. Like, his defense, second base, has really fallen off a cliff. He's had a lot of surgeries on his lower body. He's probably... They DH'd him primarily with Seattle, and he's played a little third, probably not good enough, or probably not enough to really know if he's good or bad there. It's hard to imagine him being great just because of the toll he's taken on his legs. Or is he someone who plays first base, in which case, like, he's a switch hitter, he'd work, but I think he's hit so much last year that he's probably looking at, like, a three-year deal, if not maybe more. Obviously, the defense affects his bidding, but I think he also just legit mashed where he's probably even more in terms of like a contender is going to want this bat than O'Hearn. Not to like the Sox should just not get anyone who could play for a playoff team, but just it's starting to think like, well, how could they distinguish whether it's offering more money or offering like a level of full-time reps or starter opportunity that wouldn't be available elsewhere. I don't know if I can quite square the circle with those two, but both would be like, hey, they got a good player level of excitement, which I think, like, all Sox free agency at this point, like, even if they took, like, something that feels pretty risky or something that seems like an overpay, it'd be like, well, it's interesting that they're doing something. Like, you'd almost want us, almost anything, like, big they did at this stage, I think it's like, well, yeah, it's an idea, would be kind of our base reaction.
Yeah, the White Sox, a White Sox signing since Chris Getz took over is, you mentioned him a few podcasts ago, James, from the Angels, Luis Renjifo, played 147 games last year, 76 of those games at third base. Not an impact bat at all, but he plays all over, super utility guy.
He's had flashes of impact bat. Like, he's had some pretty major injuries that have then like had a pretty long tail in terms of him looking effective again, in which case it didn't really happen all last year. So I think that would probably be more the guy like I could see be like, he's not going to get a level of guarantee of like you're going to be a major part of a rotation at another place where, you know, the White Sox could maybe say like, hey, we think he's healthy. He's, you know, shown power before. We're going to take a ride. And that would be a unique offer as opposed to like guys everyone wants for the same kind of role that they would want.
Got it. And another one I had was Willie Castro. He played 120 games last year, 23 of them at third base, 92 WRC plus 8% walk rate. And then it gets pretty dire. Adam Frazier, got a lot of podcast minutes back in 2021 about Adam Frazier. And what the hell happened to Jaime Candelario? Because he was a 10 10 weighted runs created plus. I could barely get it out. It is so bad. He is falling off a huge cliff from his 3-WAR season in 2023. That's what I got, Jim. Any of those sexy enough for you to be like, yeah, let's go for it, White Sox?
Kind of feel like, you know, you're getting towards the point of like, let's see what kind of minor league contracts are available, or let's see what, you know, who's available as teams navigate their 40-man roster. And
yeah,
you know, you get to the random waiver claims, the I would say Joshua Palacios tier of showed things before, let's give him some playing time, not too much playing time, not in the cleanup spot this time. You know, have plenty of bats in Charlotte too. I think it's a selling point for the White Sox is like, whether you're talking about on the cusp of the majors or on the major league roster, the White Sox have like two layers of opportunities. And I think first base, left-handed bat, like Bob Seymour, unfortunately, looks like he's pursuing an opportunity in Asia, but like he would be the type of, let's have just somebody who can hit the ball really hard and see if we can have one weird trick that'll make him hit the ball harder or more frequently.
Does Bob Seymour hit 40 homers if he signed with the White Sox but played in Charlotte?
Oh, yeah. I'm seeing, like, he hit, let's see. Let me hit last year. He was up there. Yeah, 30 over 105 games with Durham.
All right. Any of those seem realistic, James? Renjifo, maybe?
Renjifo, like, Candelario gets to, like, yeah, like, interesting minor league deal. His back has seemed, you know, messed up for a while. That is like I'm getting you in both areas where I'm like O'Hearn or Polanco seems like a little rich, and then you swing to the other end, and I'm disgusted by what you've turned up. Renjifo, it'll be about like how healthy he is, or you know, if there's a reason to think like, you know, they have something that can jump on from where you underperformed last year. But sure, because that seems like again like someone who they could offer a unique opportunity level. But obviously, if they marshal resources where they're like, hey, you know, we can't afford a lot, but we can afford to be the high bidder on Ryan O'Hearn, then maybe that works. But we'll have to see how they piece it around, because they do have, while they don't have, they have multiple needs. Like, they pretty much need two corner outfielders or to handle two corner outfield roles. As you know, I'm cheating and moving farther down the you know, rundown, and also starting pitching. So it just makes you think that with that, you're going to see like five or six small signings than two or three ones that are approaching more mid-size. That makes me more suspicious that it's going to be something that looks a lot more similar to last year, because like there's a similar level of like holes in the depth chart from last year.
Yeah. So could Renjifo be like the Josh Rojas signing?
Sure. Theoretically, you had more need for just infield defense last year, where up the middle, you're supposed to be a little bit more fine. But yeah, I could see it working that way. I know like defensively, he's had struggles at the end of his years in Anaheim, and his versatility might shake out in weird ways. But that's at least like the shape of at least in a couple areas, because even if they go big in one position spot, and big, I mean like, two-year deal sort of thing, that won't be representative of the body of their signings, I feel.
Well, let's go to another idea. If the White Sox are looking for a left-handed infielder, may I propose the White Sox enter the Brendan Donovan trade sweepstakes, as it's being widely reported, and I'm not exactly sure what St. Louis and their new president of baseball operations, Chaim Bloom, is trying to achieve this year. Maybe they're rebuilding, maybe they're reloading, but they are trying to offload some players, and one of them rumored is Brendan Donovan. He's going to be turning 29 for the 2026 season. His projected arbitration salary, according to MLB trade rumors, is $5.4 million. This does make a little bit sense if St. Louis is trying to get younger by moving Donovan, who has been a solid player for four seasons, Jim. And there's a part of me that thinks that the White Sox should kick the tires and see what the asking price is, because Donovan, in his 4 years with St. Louis, has been a 119 weighted runs created plus type of hitter. And we know the White Sox need more better than league average hitters. He's been a potential 3-WAR player the last couple of seasons. We know the White Sox need more 3-WAR players, especially in the position side. But where the White Sox are, like, Jim, if I had confidence that the White Sox in 2026 were an 82-win projected team, I'd say go for it. Maybe Donovan can really help solidify the infield, and it gets the White Sox closer to Kansas City, Detroit, and Cleveland. But where they are currently, and if Heim Bloom's like, yeah, I'll trade you Brandon Donovan for Caleb Bonnemer, that's where I hesitate. I back off and be like, oh, never mind. I know what the asking price is, but the White Sox are not ready yet.
No, I think it's a case where they aren't, because they haven't given a date on when they plan to be competitive. Like, you need that, I think, before you start looking at trading for a guy with only 2 years of control left. So that kind of like starts and ends there for me. It's unfortunate because, you know, Donovan, born in Germany, so he would add a name to Ted's Sporkle quiz of players on the White Sox not born in the Americas. Three other players born in Germany, two since 2010. Can you name them?
Max Kepler.
No, White Sox players.
Well, Edwin Jackson.
Edwin Jackson's one.
Oh, really? I don't know.
Will Omen.
Oh, yeah.
Military brats.
Yeah, I was about to guess Michael A. Taylor for that reason, even though I didn't think he was born from anywhere abroad, but just that's the profile.
Yeah. Tom McCarthy's the other one. So, fun fact for you.
That is a fun fact. All right. So that squashes that idea. So that's the whole, that was one of the things that was on my mind reading up on James's work on who is Chris Getz wanting to bring in that's a left-handed infielder into the mix. Other things, Grant Taylor staying in the bullpen. James, should we just squash any future idea of him ever becoming a starting pitcher?
No, I don't think so. This seems like a intermediary step. You know, if he stretches out, he was around 63 innings, I want to say, this year total between majors and minors. If he gets to like 80, because he's working two innings more, which gets said they did want him to do, and he's obviously working on expanding his pitch arsenal a little bit to have a changeup, and this would allow him to maybe turn over a lineup or face lefties more. If he succeeds, theoretically, he's in a better position, a more paddle position to stretch him out to the rotation than he is this year. Like 60 to, 120, 110. Probably a bit harder road. Fundamentally, they are very skeptical that he can hold up or his delivery will be, you know, conducive to starting, repeating. So I think they're hesitant on it. They're certainly not rushing him into it. And maybe 80 innings of Grant Taylor is like an all-star level reliever, and they're like, we can't move on from this either. But I don't think this step is never consider it ever again. I think they can probably, they're very much like pumping the brakes. And it's like, some people suggested like, hey, is this like, he can just follow the Garrett Crochet model to get things like, oh, you know, that is something that happened. And maybe we're cognizant of that, but not like trying to slap like a direct comp on that process to it. So I think it's going to move slowly. I don't think this is never going to happen. Give up, losers. You're here forever. Don't forget your free forever poster on the bullpen that, for Taylor. So it was probably going to be difficult to launch him from what he did this year to starting forever. And, you know, while they kind of think he's going to be this way, and that's kind of why they put him here sooner, rather than have him, you know, beat his head against the wall, like prove that you can't start in the minors, I don't think this was a particularly meaningful landmark where they give up on it.
I'd be curious to see if they do extend him, how those outings go in 2026, and when Will Venable makes that call. I don't know if it'd be like more six out save opportunities. That'd be kind of interesting. Because obviously you don't see a whole lot of that in Major League Baseball. But it does. Is this development path possibly on the same path as like Jordan Hicks, Jim, when St. Louis and I think it's San Francisco, right? San Francisco was the one that's trying to make Jordan Hicks a starter.
Yeah, what was innings leap that he had? Because I thought it was pretty sudden.
I mean,
it was like
not a great example since he went back.
Yeah.
And his velo dipped and he like ran out of gas in the second half of this.
Yeah, he went from a similar amount of innings, like 65 and two thirds the year before. So it was very much a, Oh, they're starting him. That's bold. So yeah, I think the crochet thing just kind of gums it up because he's proof that you can be healthier as a starter than a reliever. You know, the White Sox, their line has been that just with the way he kind of flings his entire being towards the plate and the way like his, you know, just he launches off the mound, that he can't possibly do that for 80 to 100 pitches every 5 days and hold up over the course of a season. But, you know, 20 to 35 pitches in a given outing is more manageable. And it seems like, you know, they almost, yeah, if there were for a way for them to be proven correct without it being like an injury that costs them a year, it almost seems like it'd be a relief for them versus, you know, Taylor handling the job well, and all the innings and the different shaped innings they threw at him and responding fairly well, had a couple of velocity dips here and there, but nothing that like lasted outing to outing. It was more just, you know, an isolated game or even like a second inning where the velocity tailed off and then it came back. So there's some tension right now, I think, with just pulling him off the starting project in Birmingham the way they did last year before he had proven fallible or like vulnerable to the rigors of starting. I think I wish the White Sox would have thought that out a little bit differently. Like, it would have been, I think, more sensible had there been like some kind of like Hagen Smith thing where all of a sudden he's throwing like 93 and like, oh, that's not something we want to see from him. We can't see from him. Let's pull him out of action for a few weeks and then bring him back as a reliever. Like that would have made more sense to me versus, you know, having him throwing smoke and handling all three inning outings. And just when it gets to the point where he should be throwing four innings, they put him in the bullpen and they don't really answer the question. It just kind of dangles there.
All right. Well, we don't have to have that conversation in spring training. Grant Taylor will be in the bullpen for the White Sox in 2026, but the expectation is longer outings, maybe not as often as Mike Vassell or challenge Vassell's 100 innings, but who knows? The White Sox could change their mind like they did last year with Grant Taylor. Edgar Caro, Kyle Teal sticking together now. For now, James doesn't seem like Chris Getz is really enticed in trading either one this upcoming offseason.
Well, I think we know which one they would trade. Teal's the one that has been spoken out behind the scenes is like having a higher defensive ceiling. Is the one obviously this front office traded for. He hit better and is more just like a kind of a raw power profile, whereas Caro's more know how to hit. They just kind of seem to say, and we're already hearing leaks reports freak out of like teams asking on Caro, but they seem to feel like it's going to be a kind of the same buy low opportunism with Robert. Maybe not quite the same because like Caro's not low or like performing worse than he should before. It's like them believing he's a top 100 prospect. He's a starting quality catcher. He probably doesn't quite look like that quite yet. If the, having the offensive year where he held his own, definitely very good for 22-year-old rookie catcher, but didn't show like big power where you can be super confident he's going to hit enough to be an asset there with the bat. And then, a lot of soft skills where he did pretty good, but obviously very poor framing numbers in the outset. And, some skepticism about how much he'll get beyond like a tick below average. That's kind of the ideal developmental home for it rather than someone who's going to create a ton of value there or be super toolsy in terms of like his, stealing base, numbers. Obviously the White Sox kind of have issues with controlling the running games, an organization that he's punished by statistically, but it's not like a Corey Lee Cannon where you're expecting him to be an asset back there either. So it's a bat first catcher, at least in terms of statistical profile, as much as he, very much as good at the soft skills of catching and very invested in it. And you haven't seen that bat really leap up yet. So they just don't think they're going to get, probably not going to get great value for this. And that this isn't quite a situation where you got two guys who got to be in the lineup every single day and they're in kind of like inhibiting each other. You saw a little bit of that. Maybe you wanted to see them get more at bats, but certainly as rookies, they felt like they managed their workload with that a little bit. I don't think it's quite at that boiling point of like, this town ain't big enough for the both of them just yet. Like you could see that down the road. Certainly like that'd be a good problem if it both goes well. Maybe there's a world where Teal emerges as a starter or Caro kind of settles into like a good backup more than anything else or vice versa. They just don't think they're at this critical mass yet where they need to pull the trigger or they're going to get the most for their, you know, somewhat limited coffer of trade chips if they go for it now. So that's why it's unlikely, I think, but it's obviously something that's being actively considered. It's kind of like the obvious thing to look at if you ever see them just trading present major league value. I don't know where else you'd start beyond Luis Robert than, you know, your compelling young prospect, but still on the upswing catcher.
So, Jim, if the White Sox don't trade Iker Caro, you good with that?
Yeah, I mean, it's better than the alternative, which is trading him because they feel like they have to trade him because they did create this situation for themselves. I think that was the one thing everybody pointed out about the Crochet trade is like, pretty good package. Don't you kind of already have a catcher of the future? And so this is the, you know, one of the possible outcomes is where they both arrive at the same time and you have to navigate that. The way it could work out in the White Sox favor is if they do give Teal like the number one catcher type treatment and then like save Carroll for the plate appearances they figure will make him look good. Like if they, there's a way for them to shape it to where like they can cover for Caro's weaknesses, have, if Teal's going to be their guy, they can put Teal out there, you know, lefty on lefty, you know, if it's a, if that's a game where they feel like, you know, one of these guys is going to go 0-for-4, Teal can wear it. We feel it'll help him, you know, have starts in the future versus having like Caro, you know, be in situations where like, here's a guy we think he can turn around and crush. We're going to have him start this game and we're going to arrange, you know, Teal might have to wear it for a year, or at least, you know, his numbers might take a hit. But if like Caro's posting like a 750 plus OPS because he's getting like the plum assignments and the White Sox, you know, can say in trade talks that, hey, we, you know, we're not holding him back. We're just, we have to play Teal because he's our guy. You know, there's a way for them to drum up his value a little bit and have him show more in the majors without, and have it work to their favor. So, and there's also a case where like Teal gets a foul tip and like they need a catcher and Caro is a very good player to take those. It's valuable for him to take those games. So there's a way it can work out. I think it's just right now a little bit awkward in how you talk about it until the White Sox like ultimately tip their hand that, and I think Teal still has to earn a little bit to be the guy because, you know, he has some things in his game to shore up. Certainly doesn't hurt to keep him honest and, you know, make sure that he's progressing the way they want him to. But yeah, I think that's the positive way to spin it from a situation where, you know, ultimately you have two guys who might not be in the kind of playing time they need to in order to take the next step.
We at Sox Machine are happy to follow the lead of our friends over at the All Sports Scene and fellow White Sox blogs and podcasts in participating in the Southside Food Drive. Here's how you can help us raise money to help our Chicago neighbors who are in need. Join our virtual food drive to help raise donations to the Greater Chicago Food Depository. Every $1 donated helps provide three meals, and the generous donations help keep food pantries throughout Chicago stocked. Together, we have already raised more than $20,000 for the food drive. That's more than 60,000 meals. Thank you so much to those who have already donated. If you have the means, any help would be well appreciated. You can join the Southside Food Drive and donate by visiting the events page on SoxMachine.com. And then finally, Andrew Benintendi. James, it sounds like the White Sox are not very confident with all of these Achilles injuries that Benintendi has been dealing with, that the chances of him becoming the defensive player that won Gold Glove back a few years ago in left field, that time has probably passed. So it seems like if Benintendi playing time, try to draw it up for him in 2026, seems like he's going to be DHing more this upcoming season.
I mean, he already kind of did DH a fair amount. He only played 69 games left field in 2025. So it's more like you certainly can't see that number going back up any significant amount. Yeah, I kind of asked, like, you're obviously not signing him up for 140 games in the outfield. And Chris said, like, I don't think Benny wants to do that. Like, that's kind of the reality of the last 2 years where the Achilles has fired up on him multiple times, which is both affecting the metrics and also affecting just how many times he can really be out there. So it was more like getting him on record to acknowledge the situation than, you know, he expressed confidence like we think he can still play the outfield. Yeah, I don't think glove form is coming back. I obviously they hope he's closer to average than he's been, but it's just the reality of he just got another year older. It's his effect in the last 2 years. You can't possibly just plan out your team with the idea that he's going to have a resurgence in how much left field he can handle or how good it will be. So that's why I look at just an off season where they're kind of spread out in terms of resources, where you need to add, you know, unless you're having like a big, you know, Brooks Baldwin playing outfield playing time guarantee, so to speak, where you're really like staking him out, like he's going to be a regular in one of the corners, and you're deciding that now rather than maybe something dictated by how he looks in spring or how he plays. You have to add basically two starting level outfielders in the corners during the off season. Obviously, they accomplished it by a platoon with in one spot with, you know, Tauchman and Slater. Obviously, Slater helped out Benintendi a little bit too, but that was something they did last year to kind of, you know, do things a little bit cheaply or you know, find their way towards finding guys who could play defense, but not, you know, signing up for, you know, someone who can play good defense and hits both sides of the pitchers. That's pretty expensive. So they didn't go that route. So it creates a need for real bodies there that, you know, they need to find a solution to, because, you know, they have to make a decision on Tauchman for, non-tendering, but, you know, Michael A. Taylor retired. That dude appeared in over 120 games last season to fill both platoon reasons and defense. And, you know, Austin Slater, that, you know, you could bring him back. He's kind of the same guy he was and filled the same need that you have, but they have those three signings they made. There aren't really any internal replacements for them unless they're willing to kind of stamp what Brooks Baldwin's going to be. And if anything, they've kind of emphasized versatility with him so much. I don't think they're going to say like, yeah, actually he's our primary left fielder or right fielder at this stage in the offseason, at least. So that's where I really think there's just a lot of volume they have to add in the offseason.
Mike Yastrzemski and Cedric Mullins, just like our last podcast, sharing my offseason plan. Sounds like it's more of a need.
I was trying to picture like a three-legged race with Tauchman and Slater, but turns out their meniscus was the same knee. Otherwise, you could have tied them together. Yeah.
Oh man, well, the outfield is going it's going to be a focus point again. Goes back to the left-handed corner infielder. If they can play third base, great. I was more expecting to hear we need a left-handed hitting outfielder. yes you do. Very obvious, Chris.
They need
Stats.
Like a like this is a case where they need their own Ryan O'Hearn. Not Ryan O'Hearn specifically, but, you know, according, you know, to the Baltimore timeline of just finding somebody else's cast off and turning him into something. Like, this is the playing time, both at first base and the outfield, to where let's go to work, Ryan Fuller, on finding another Ryan, another latent Ryan.
See who gets cut after the 40-man protection. Maybe that'll be some targets for the White Sox and we can add them to the list. But no, great stuff, James, for your reporting from Las Vegas. And huge thank you to everyone at Sox Machine, especially our supporters, to making that happen. We are going to be going to the winter meetings in Orlando in December. So that'll be the next remote that we'll be doing for Sox Machine. Jim and I will be joining James down in Orlando. So that's the question I pose to you guys. With the 40-man protection deadline coming up, a lot of activity, a lot of news on Tuesday, November 18th throughout Major League Baseball, especially knowing which players accept or decline the qualifying offer. Jim, I'll start with you. What are you watching for between now, November 18th, on the protection deadline, and until we arrive in Orlando for the winter meetings for the White Sox?
Coaching staff would, I think, be the one where it's more or less
who's left?
Mandatory first base coach, and then catcher or offensive coordinator, or any kind of the roles that may or may not exist. We'll see if they create any new roles, see if they subtract any roles, but just having finalized, I think, would be the big one that feels like they need to do it. between now.
On the catching front, though, isn't that Walker McKibben, though? Isn't he taking that role?
He's going to handle the catching. He will remain the bench coach.
So, yeah, I mean, like, but they could, you know, maybe use that spot for a different kind of offensive coach.
So there won't be a catching coach. They won't be replacing Drew Patera's title.
But, yeah, so they have a couple coaches they had last year that, you know, Grady Sizemore, offensive coordinator, now the first base coach in Minnesota. So, like, do they have the same amount of coaches? Do they have, are they down one? Do they have a new title nobody can explain? I think that's kind of the loose end in terms of things they have to do. As for things that, like, they'd want to do, like, this is kind of the time where they sign a guy for a one-year deal that, you know, the under $3 million, and I think that's probably between now and the winter meetings when they strike.
Yes. Who is the Austin Slater signing that's incoming in the next week? That's my bold prediction. The White Sox are signing a free agent. How about you, James?
It would be great if it's once again Austin Slater and he once again says that he was the top target.
Yes. What are you watching for, James, between now and the winter meetings for the White Sox?
I guess who doesn't get protected for the Rule 5 draft, because that's now big business for the White Sox these days. That's relevant, I suppose. I'm trying to find out more about, like, the coaching staff and their preparation, maybe through that, you know, setting up some interviews with coaching pitching coaches that, you know, kind of figure out what their vision is for players. I guess it's more of a content preview than what I'm looking to happen, but that's what I'm focusing my energy on, is I think getting in a view of, like, how they see the ceiling that's left or the meat on the bone developmentally for some of the guys they have, might be telling, or it might be representative. What I'm really looking forward is whether Lenny and so once again, you know, how deep can this reign of terror over Venezuelan Winter League, where he's once again playing, which seems ridiculous for a guy coming off a 20 plus homer season in the majors, to be,
I thought,
you know,
they didn't want him to play.
They realized it was, there was no stopping him.
Really? They're just going to be like, Lenin, don't play.
I don't recall, like, them saying, like, specifically don't want him to play. I only recall, like, Chris talking, like, a level of resignation of, like, he loves to play, he's going to play.
So it's fine when Sam Antonacci does it, but when Lenin Sosa does it.
It wasn't said with, like, a level of, like, we wanted him, not any views, but he's down on BREP with 8 games in Caracas again. Just a 989 OPS. I don't think he's really gotten going down there yet.
Is Lenin going to play for the Venezuelan World Baseball Classic team?
I don't know, but, you know, you'd think he'd be willing. You know, one, it would involve more baseball games, and, you know, he'd be swinging for the moment, I'm sure, if he got that opportunity. He wouldn't get cheated on such a big stage.
He's the Eric Andre gif of just the let me in whenever there's baseball, especially the Venezuelan uniform. Part of me wants the White Sox to sign O'Hearn, just because I think, you know, my theory that I have, like, in the back of my mind is, like, the more you block Lenin, the more he plays or balls out, to where, like, all of a sudden, like, he's back. We can't, we have to keep playing him, and he'll play, make the maddening error every 8 games that, you know, makes you not want to play him. But then he just keeps hitting more and more. So just keep making him angry, I think, is the way you manage him.
Let's call it now. Left field platoon, Jim. Lenin Sosa, Andrew Benintendi.
So much room for activities and left.
Oh, might be the best hitting position, though.
Another three-legged outfielder, like, time together.
Well, let us know in the comments section what you guys are watching for. Based on the comments section, just catching up here, as James mentioned, yes, a lot of you are still upset that the White Sox are not going to spend money. Jerry, just please sell the team to Justin so we can get this over with. I hear you. I get you. I understand where you are coming from. But from us, we have to take a realistic approach as far as covering this team, knowing that Jim is probably spot on with the payroll being around $90 million and trying to search and who are going to be those guys that the White Sox target this offseason and report on that. It won't be as sexy, though, on our final topic of this podcast as what Seattle just did. The first big free agent signing is a re-signing. Jim, you wrote about it on SoxMachine.com. Josh Naylor, after Seattle acquired him via trade, that trade really worked out well for the Seattle Mariners. Now Naylor stays in Seattle 5 years, over $92 million. And it seems that Seattle, lineup-wise, really has a strong core in Julio Rodriguez, Cal Raleigh, and now Josh Naylor, Jim.
Yeah, and, you know, it's surprising when you think about a couple of years ago and the way, you know, Naylor looked like a kind of a bad-bodied first baseman. You know, great left-handed bat, but would you have to platoon him in order to get the most out of the position? You know, how is he going to age? And all of a sudden, like, he gets the free agency as a power-hitting average defense first baseman who all of a sudden steals 30 bases and now is among the youngest players in free agency to where he's, you know, physically one of the better bets with how he, like, uses his physicality for, you know, lack of a better word. And then, you know, you have the combination of enough power and few strikeouts, or at least few strikeouts for a guy who hits with as much power as he does. So it's an odd bet, but also, like, when you see, like, what skills teams are prioritizing, and that, like, he doesn't need a platoon partner and he provides base running value somehow. And he, you know, does not, diminish from balls in play or opportunities to create 90s, as Derek Showman would say. I think that sounds like we're going to be hearing that a lot for terminology. That's, yeah, I guess that's, you know, a worthwhile contract. It seems like, you know, it could get ugly maybe in the back half of it, but given that the Mariners have to win now, like, they have to put their best team forth now in order to keep spending money later, just to keep capitalizing on the excitement and enthusiasm. That, yeah, it's fine.
Yeah, I think it's a solid signing. I thought that he'd be around $100 million, but he falls short of that. But they have him for his 29 through his age 34 season at $18.5 million. No trade clause for Josh Naylor.
That's, I mean, that's good for Seattle in a way, because, like, that's, wasn't the knock on them that with the location, the travel, that, like, Seattle had a harder time pulling free agents. So if he wants to be there and he doesn't want to be traded from there without his permission, like, that's not bad for him, reputation-wise.
So that's the first one. We'll see on the qualifying offer. There's a lot of interesting names there that I think I would, like, advise them to accept the qualifying offer. Do you think anyone does, or is the impression, James, that you heard from the GM meetings that everyone's going to decline?
There is skepticism that people will be interested in the qualifying hour right before an expected lockout year.
Yeah, because, like, Brandon Woodruff, I would advise maybe taking it, because I don't think he's going to beat $22 million. Gleyber Torres is another that I would, like, you should think about it. And then, you know, Shoto Imanaga. That whole situation with the Cubs, I don't have a good feel for it. I don't know if it makes sense for him to accept it or not, after both sides seem to decline whatever options that were already baked into the contract that he initially signed with the Chicago Cubs. But that also makes sense, James, that if everybody declines it, I get it, before a lockout. Try to get a multi-year deal so at least you have something in writing to get a little cash in 2027. But we'll see what activity happens. We'll see what the news is on Tuesday, November 18th. And, of course, we will be reporting that on SoxMachine.com. But thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. If you just discovered the Sox Machine Podcast, you can subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts, such as Spotify and Apple Music. You can also listen to the show and watch our videos on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/SoxMachine. Follow us on social media. We're on all the platforms at Sox Machine. You can follow James at JR Fegan. You can follow me at SoxMachine_Josh. If you enjoy our work and want full access to all of our coverage of the Chicago White Sox and Major League Baseball, sign up to become a Sox Machine supporter at SoxMachine.com. Our subscriptions, start at $5 a month. We do have annual subscriptions as well to give you a discount that gets you the ad-free version of both the show and the website and unlocks the comment section. We do have a couple spots open in our veterans committee, so if you want the juicy gossip that James was sharing from all the murmurs and whispers from Las Vegas, the GM meetings, you can gain access to that by signing up to become part of the Sox Machine Veterans Committee on SoxMachine.com. The Sox Machine Podcast is a production of SoxMachine.com, your home for all things Chicago White Sox baseball and part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Alongside Jim Margulis and James Fegan, I'm Josh Nelson. Thanks for listening and watching.